Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
This is the takeaway for Thursday, October 26th, 2017.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. Thank you for being with us today. And it's our last day broadcasting from KERA here in Dallas. We're here on the day the U.S. government is set to release previously classified files on the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. It's a story that thrust Dallas into the center of the world 54 years ago. We'll have a lot more, including my trip to Dealey Plaza, later in the hour. But we begin today in Puerto Rico, where Hurricane Maria made landfall 36 days ago. More than 5 weeks later, only 25% of residents in Puerto Rico have electrical power. Here's Father Carlos Gonzalez. He's a priest and a doctor from San Juan who's been without power for 4 weeks.
In general, it's extremely difficult to continue every day. People are getting tired because they were expecting this to last maybe for a week or two at the most. It's been a month already since the hurricane, and things don't seem to get much better.
We're going to hear more from Father Gonzalez in just a few minutes, but first, we wanted to look at the electrical grid itself and why it's been such a struggle to restore power on the island. About 80% of Puerto Rico's electrical grid was damaged during the storm, and this week, it was reported that the Puerto Rico Electric Power Authority, known as PREPA, awarded a contract to rebuild the island's grid to a two-year-old company from Montana called Whitefish Energy. Now, Whitefish had just two full-time employees on the day that Hurricane Maria made landfall in Puerto Rico. They also happened to be headquartered in the hometown of Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke, although we should note that the Interior Department says they had nothing whatsoever to do with this deal. But Maggie Kurth-Baker has been looking at this deal between PREPA and Whitefish and also looking at other deals that PREPA has made in Puerto Rico. She's senior science writer for 538. Maggie, good to have you back.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Maggie, what about this price, $300 million to Whitefish for the grid? That's a lot for a job like this, or at least it sounds like it. Do people believe the contract could have been gotten for cheaper?
There are some good reasons why you might go for a specialty contractor rather than wanting to bring in somebody who works for a municipal utility in Florida or Texas. And that is because of Puerto Rico's geography. You know, we're talking about utility transmission lines that are running from the south of the island, where there is most of the electricity generation, to the north of the island, where there is most of the electricity demand, which is its own problem right there. But these lines have to run through tropical forest mountains. And those mountains, even on a good day, a lot of the places you need to get to are not accessible by road. And right now, a lot of the roads that do exist are washed out by the hurricane that took down the electrical poles as well.
So does Whitefish make the argument that they are uniquely qualified to do this special kind of mountainous tropical work?
That is the argument that they've been making. It's a little hard to know whether that's a reasonable argument for them to make. Earlier in the month, the newspaper Caribbean Business interviewed the CEO of Whitefish and asked him about similar jobs that they'd done, and he cited a $500,000 contract in Washington State that also took place in a mountain. That is a much smaller job than what we're talking about here. Whitefish had only gotten their first $1 million government contract just before the hurricane happened, so they don't really have a track record. On the other hand, some of the people that I spoke with in Puerto Rico feel like they're not doing a bad job. One of my contacts down there is Jose Maiso, who used to be the executive director for the Puerto Rico State Office of Energy Policy. And, you know, he said that from what he's seen, this work is getting done on these transmission lines as fast as it possibly could. You know, they seem to be doing a decent job of securing these expert subcontractors, getting the specialty equipment to where it needs to be, and getting the lines fixed.
What about oversight? Are the details of this contract, what individual linemen are getting paid, what foremen are getting paid, is all that out in the open, and is it normal?
So that is where it starts to be a little bit difficult. It is not normal for how contracting is typically done with utility, you know, emergency labor contracts like this. Typically, what you would do is go through an organization of municipal utilities, which would sort of connect your utility with these other utilities that have available labor, and then the different utilities would work out a contract among themselves. And from what we can tell, PREPA never tried to contact that organization. You know, as early as October 9th, they were giving these really weird answers to E&E News, claiming that they couldn't possibly contact the organization because of communication outages, but at the same time somehow got through to Whitefish immediately. So there's a lot of weirdness that's happening here. But this is also fairly normal for PREPA. We're talking about a utility that has a history of not very well documented, not very well thought out contracting processes.
Well, it's all certainly very irregular, Maggie, although it does seem that if a couple of months from now the lights are on and they're working well in Puerto Rico, people might turn to some other problem.
I think that that is probably quite true. I mean, because it's out of the ordinary, and it's also not wildly out of the ordinary for PREPA. And kind of what I came away with from my research was this impression that basically, even if this case does demonstrate conflict of interest on the part of the Trump administration, that issue probably isn't the only driving factor explaining why the Puerto Rican utility agreed to a poorly documented contract with a little-known company. You know, that is normal behavior for that utility.
Maggie Kurth-Baker, senior science writer for 538. Maggie, it's been great having you again.
Thank you very much.
When Hurricane Harvey flooded Houston and the Texas Gulf Coast back in August, tens of thousands of people were forced out of their homes and to relocate to shelters and hotels across the state. For low-income Texans, the disruption to home and to work and to income hit especially hard. Courtney Collins is a reporter and producer for KERA News here in Dallas, where we are today. And she's been following financially unstable residents in North Texas as part of the series One Crisis Away. One of the residents that Courtney has spent time with is Daphne Griffin. She's a mother of five living in Beaumont, Texas, before the storm hit. Daphne's home was flooded. Her family came to the Dallas area, and then, like so many other low-income disaster victims, faced major challenges getting back on their feet. I recently sat down with Courtney to learn a little bit more about Daphne's story.
She was actually in Lake Charles, Louisiana, when Katrina hit with her disabled partner. He was in a wheelchair. She had to actually, as she told me, push him out of the home on a twin bed mattress because she couldn't get his wheelchair out of the doorframe and flee that way. She ended up resettling in the Beaumont, Port Arthur area, and that's where she's been ever since. But when she heard reports of Harvey, she was not willing to wait it out and see what happened. So she evacuated with her mom, her dad, her husband, and her five children, and ended up in a shelter in Dallas.
What happened to her home in Port Arthur?
Well, she has been back to see it. Damage was pretty significant. She said with the exception of the living room, every single other room in the home was pretty much deluged with water.
We're 90% underwater. Every home out there is destroyed. So basically, we have to look for somewhere else to go.
Interesting story, actually. When she got back to see the damage in Beaumont, she arrived at night. They opened the door and started kind of pulling the salvageable living room furniture out and loaded it into the truck, tried to come back the next day to look at the rest of the rooms in the home. And her landlord had actually changed the locks and said she hadn't paid September's rent, even though she had evacuated. Her belongings were there. She owed that rent, padlocked the place, and Daphne has not been able to get back in since, which means no FEMA inspector visit and no disaster aid applied for.
You've been following lots of stories like Daphne's of when the storm hits. It's one thing to get out of the house. It's one thing to avoid the flooding. It's another thing to pay the bills. It's another thing to pay the rent.
Exactly. That's why we're calling this series One Crisis Away After the Flood, because for a lot of people, even folks that have decided to resettle somewhere else and start over, the economic impact is so disruptive. They don't have a lot of savings. They don't have a big disaster emergency fund they can dip into to start over. So what she's having to do is basically rely on the kindness of strangers. Her and her husband quickly decided to get a job. They were able to find a rental house in Arlington, Texas, but it's because of some kindness of some church members they were able to get in there and pay the deposit. And actually, Daphne has an interesting story about someone she met at a Greek Orthodox church in Dallas who was able to help her get into a rental home in Arlington.
She came with a check and paid the first month rent, and then she paid the deposit, which the lady, being that we're from Hurricane Harvey, she wanted a high deposit because she was scared. So she made us pay $5,000 deposit.
That is a really nice story of charity and the kindness of strangers. That's not an economic policy, and that's not something that most people in Daphne's situation would be lucky enough to get.
Right. She knows she's fortunate to have found some people that have kind of taken her family under their wings and feels very lucky to be in that situation. But long story short, even without the kindness of strangers, once someone starts over, they have to figure out a way to get income coming in again. So her and her husband were able to get a job. They're actually, ironically, working in flood abatement. So they punch holes in drywall when there's been a commercial or residential flood and get everything out of the home or business. That is not her heart's desire. It's not what she wants to be doing with her time, but she has to pay the bills.
We just started back working, and it's hard when you don't have any money at all and you had to scuffle for gas and just to get back and forth to work.
Flood abatement, working paycheck to paycheck. Daphne and her family are getting by. It sounds like just barely. What would she like to be doing?
So Daphne's true heart's desire is she's a beautifully creative cook. When she was in Beaumont, Port Arthur, she had a business where she cooked soul food out of a food cart. She loved it. So she's trying to keep that going on the side. The folks at the church that she met actually printed up a whole bunch of new business cards for her. She's hoping to be able to do some catering for weddings, for birthday parties, anniversary parties. She's already done a birthday since she's been here. Her littlest daughter is about to turn 1 year old. Again, I'm not making this up. This child's name is Stormy. And her first birthday party's coming up in a couple weeks, and Daphne's going to make a 5-tiered cake and just blow it out and invite the entire daycare so she can kind of show off her cooking skills and feel like she's back home again.
Is Daphne here in the Dallas area to stay?
That's what she says. She's in Arlington renting a home. She says she loves North Texas. When she was in the shelter in the Dallas area before she got into her permanent residence, she told me that it was really the attitude and the response of the community that made her want to just start over here. She thinks there's nothing really left for her back in Beaumont. You know, she's lost all this furniture. Her rental home is kind of shuttered. She isn't able to access it again. So she figures, why not start over somewhere where the people are kind and she feels like there's a future?
Well, you've reported this whole series, One Crisis Away, about Americans really on the economic edge. Now you have One Crisis Away After the Flood, all of the financial and economic pressures of a major storm like Harvey. What does Daphne's story tell you really about people either in Texas or in this country who really do live one paycheck away from having their lives uprooted?
I think what's really clear to me is that a natural disaster can upend everything. If you don't have a lot of savings or a big social safety net or a family that can bail you out, when your rental home is destroyed and you lose all your furniture and you're not able to apply for disaster assistance, there isn't a plan B. You have to kind of make your own way. So it's really clear to me that when you're on the financial edge, when you don't have a lot of backup plans in place and something happens like this, it infiltrates every aspect of your life. Daphne lost her home. She lost her furniture. Her kids lost most of their clothes. And she lost her livelihood. She lost that food vendor cart and her ability to do what she'd always been doing. So she had to move somewhere, find a new place to live, replace everything she'd lost, get her kids settled in a new school, and basically find a new way to live and find a new way to make money. And that's a lot for a lot of people to take on. This is a 30-year-old woman with a husband and 5 kids. I think that's a tall order for any of us.
This is a resilient woman.
Absolutely.
Courtney Collins, reporter and producer here at KERA. Thanks for having us.
Thanks. I appreciate it.
There's a contentious presidential election in Kenya today. Kenya already had an election back in August, and President Uhuru Kenyatta won re-election. But then the country's Supreme Court annulled the results after opposition claims of vote rigging and corruption, and they ordered a new election. But now opposition leader Raila Odinga has pulled out of the race entirely and urged his supporters to boycott today's vote. Wairumu Gitahi is the founder of Media 20 Productions and joins me now from Nairobi, Kenya. Wairimo, welcome back.
Thank you.
What's the scene like at polling places today?
Well, it was as many people would have expected. The strongholds where Raila has many supporters have very few voters. And then those ones of the incumbent president, Uhuru Kenyatta, have quite a number of voters. We've also witnessed in a number of areas where there are protests. For example, there's a stronghold for Raila called Kibra. And in some of these areas, there's a specific area near a primary school called Olympic. There, protesters are stopping people from going to vote. And voting until now hasn't started. The polling stations were supposed to be opened at 6 a.m. And in that specific area around that school, voting has not started yet because protesters are hurling stones at the police. The police are throwing tear gas canisters at them. And there's quite a bit of protests going on there.
So with the protests going on, as you say, with many people boycotting and others not being permitted to vote for various reasons, what does that predict about how Kenyans will interpret the legitimacy of this election?
You see, the thing is that both President Uhuru and Raila have quite a number of voters. In fact, sometimes people see it as 50-50. So this, of course, will bring very many questions of legitimacy, because, as you know, if probably like around 40 or 50% of the population doesn't agree with the outcome of the results or did not vote, obviously that brings a problem. The president, I think, will have a hard time in conducting his daily affairs as a president in the country.
And what's the big issue? What's the major issue for Kenyans as they head to the polls this time?
Okay, for those ones who are supporting NASA, meaning those ones who are supporting Raila, they say that they have no faith in the commission that is carrying on the IEBC, the one responsible for the voting process. So they say that they didn't do a good job before, so why should they do a good job now? While the ones who are supporting Uhuru Kenyatta are saying when the court annulled the elections, the court did not say that the IEBC, the commission that is taking care of the elections, should reorganize itself. It didn't say that. It just said that they should just take a number of precautions, change a couple of things, and then go ahead and do the elections. So that has been like the bone of contention. They have been concentrating on that and not too much on the development issues, which are the major issues actually affecting the country. That's why, I mean, you go to vote. That's why you want a specific president.
So then the question becomes, what's being lost in the national debate in Kenya with all of this fighting over the legitimacy of elections?
Exactly. In fact, businesses have really gone down. I mean, one of the organizations that has businessmen came out and said that they are losing a lot of money. You see, when also you have demonstrations, there's a lot of looting that goes on. Life in Kenya now has become just about politics. Yesterday was a public holiday. Today is a public holiday. We had other public holidays the last time we had elections, and people are unsure what happens after today. So obviously it's affecting the everyday life of people. In fact, many people say that they are exhausted by this process, that it should just come to an end. But the way things are looking, probably today is not really the end, or these elections are not the end.
A second presidential election in Kenya, and Wairimu Gitahi says it's not the end for wrangling over the legitimacy. Wairimu, thanks for being here.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Wairimu Gitahi of Media 20 in Nairobi. Let's go to Washington now and to Congress, where Republicans are desperate for a win, and they're hoping they're going to get one with big tax reform and big tax cuts that President Trump has been promising since the campaign. Well, now President Trump has vowed to protect 401k retirement plans as part of the tax overhaul, but GOP House and Senate leaders say they might not be on board. Here to give us the latest on tax reform, on 401ks, and how they could make tax cuts and tax reform much harder for Republicans is Heather Long, economics correspondent for The Washington Post. Heather, good to have you back.
Hi, Todd.
Heather, how did the president and powerful Republican tax writers get into a conflict here over 401ks?
Yeah, it's certainly a bit of a messy conflict. I was looking at the numbers yesterday, and over 62 million Americans have 401ks. So that's about a third of the adult population. So that's why there's a lot of attention on what's going on with these retirement accounts that are so popular in this country. The reason that we're in this debate is very simple, and that is Republicans, both the president and in Congress, want to do really big, large tax cuts. And they need to pay for those somehow. You can't just cut all those taxes and then have this big hole in the federal budget. So they are looking for money anywhere they can to help pay for this plan. And one of the ideas that is under serious consideration is to re-examine how whether retirement accounts like 401ks should get such a nice tax break for a lot of middle-class Americans.
That means that Republicans on the Hill are considering dialing down the parts of your 401k that are tax exempt, right? Using the money to pay for those big tax cuts that they want. But how did the president get at odds with them? I guess he's been on Twitter.
Yeah. So he took to Twitter Monday to try to clamp down. He called this 401k a great and popular tax break for the middle class, that it would not be touched. And then yesterday we had the top tax writer on the Republican side, Representative Kevin Brady from Texas. And he was at odds with the president. He was saying they are exploring ideas and that this is a negotiation that's on the table. And later in the day, the president was asked about it again. So wait a minute, what's going on here? Are you all at odds? And he left the door open this time. So on Monday, he was very solid. No way are we changing these 401k accounts. On Wednesday, he too used similar language in that afternoon to say he doesn't want to change them, but it is an active negotiation.
So maybe this is a blip on the road to tax reform. I mean, Heather, it doesn't get much more personal for people and their finances than the 401k. This is not arguing over some arcana buried in the tax code that only a lobbyist cares about.
Exactly. Like I was saying, 62 million Americans would be impacted. At the moment, you can put up to $18,000 tax-free a year into a 401k. It's even more if you're over 50 and trying to catch up on your retirement account savings. And so if we move that down to 2,400, which is one of the numbers that have been floated, you know, there's a lot of people who would suddenly lose that tax break. Now, the Republicans like Kevin Brady are saying, wait a minute, we all agree that we need to save more for retirement. So instead of doing it through the 401k, which you can put the money in tax-free up front, and then you only pay tax when you take it out in your 60s or 70s or 80s as you retire and draw down, he says, let's flip that around. Let's have people move from 401ks to what are called Roth IRAs. And with a Roth IRA, these exist now, you put the money in at the beginning that you've already paid tax on. So I would take money that's already paid tax through my paycheck, put that into the Roth IRA, and then when I take it out in my 60s, 70s, or 80s, I wouldn't have to pay tax down the road. But the big benefit, if I'm Kevin Brady and I'm sitting there in Congress trying to make the math work, is that if we move to Roth IRAs, the government gets the tax money now in the next several years, which helps pay for those tax cuts.
That helps, you just said it, that helps pay for those big tax cuts that are embedded in the thing they call tax reform. Republicans, as I said, are desperate to get tax reform done. They're having a spat with the president over your 401ks. Will they get tax reform done? It's important to them. We're going to be covering that here on The Takeaway in the weeks to come. Heather Long with The Washington Post. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
White nationalist demonstrations in Charlottesville, Virginia, in August left one woman dead and also pushed the country into a debate over Confederate monuments and how they reflect our communities. There are more than 700 monuments to the Confederacy in America today, and thousands of streets and parks and schools named for Confederate figures. Here in Dallas, Mayor Mike Rawlings created a task force on Confederate monuments and asked them for recommendations on how the city should deal with them. Frances Cujo Waters was named the chairperson.
What I tried to do as the chair is to make it not a referendum on all things race-related, all things Confederacy-related, but to really narrow our scope as to what we in Dallas could really manage in terms of our monuments and our naming systems.
Cudjoe Waters organized a series of public meetings where Texans weighed in.
I'm aghast at why we think it appropriate to honor those who sought to tear down the very union that provides for our collective strength as a beacon of liberty and justice in this world.
If the city of Dallas needs a place to store these statues at no cost, you can store them in my front yard.
America did not invent slavery, but found it to be the answer to a farming need.
Any evidence of Confederate honor on public property needs to be erased. And it's almost tearful to say that, but I saw enough racism last week that it's got to change. It's got to change.
It was a long process, some of it very contentious. Still, Frances Cudjoe Waters says the task force tackled how to deal with everything from street names to park names and monuments here in the city of Dallas.
Interestingly, the two monuments in question were put in Dallas at very strategic times. The Confederate Monument in Pioneer Park was put there in 1896. Not surprisingly, that was about the same time. That was when we had Plessy v. Ferguson, a landmark Supreme Court case, when we were really looking at the country trying to start to put in black codes in the beginning of Jim Crow. So the monument was put there for a very particular reason. It was not about celebrating the Confederacy per se, but it was about sort of celebrating what the Confederacy represented in terms of intimidation of a particular population. The Robert E. Lee statue, which was commissioned by the Daughters of the Confederacy, again, 50 years after the war ended, was placed there at a time when there were poll taxes for voting. There was intimidation going on of the African-American community. So the timing of it was far less related historically to a Confederate movement as opposed to really being timed with what was happening in that contemporary moment around race relations in Dallas.
So you've evaluated all this history. You've tried to evaluate Dallas's place in this history. The committee has come up with recommendations. What are they?
There were a couple of things. The one thing that the city council went ahead and moved on prior to our recommendations was that they would go ahead and vote to remove the Robert E. Lee statue and put it in storage until our recommendations came forward.
So one statue of Robert E. Lee was already removed. What were the other recommendations that you came up with?
For the Robert E. Lee statue and for the Confederate monument, we had a variety of ideas and opinions on the task force. Some wanted to have those monuments destroyed. Others wanted to keep them in place and thought they should continue to be prominently displayed. And I asked them to look at three things. One, what is the role of art? Two, what is the role of art and historic monument in particular in the public square? And so I wanted us to talk honestly and openly about the fact that when we put things in the public square, it's a celebration or acknowledgement that we are societally affirming what that statue represents. And then the final question I asked was, I wanted us to think about what are our values as a city of Dallas. And so through very difficult deliberation and in light of a lot of important learning that we did, we decided that we wanted to remove them from the public square. They could stay in Dallas, but we wanted them in educational institutions with context, so museums that could give further context to the entire Civil War reality or the entire context of what was happening during that time.
But what about park names, street names, all of the other things around town?
On streets, there were 21 streets we could have changed. We decided to only recommend the changing of three. One of the key pieces of information that we got around parks is that in Dallas, the names expire after 40 years anyway. The statue for Robert E. Lee was placed there in 1936, so that means the name expired in 1976. And the Dallas policy is that it reverts back to the placeholder name. The park is in a part of town called Oak Lawn, so it became Oak Lawn Park. And then if anyone wants to go through the process now, we have a very clear process for how you name parks. And if you can get Robert E. Lee through in 2017, that's a whole other story. For Fair Park, which is a very big, important monument here, it has National Historic Landmark status. We decided to let that stay as it was, and what we asked for there was to add context, to add education, but more importantly, to add other images. And then this is really probably the most important recommendation as far as I'm concerned around Fair Park. The Robert E. Lee statue was put into place in 1936. During the centennial of Dallas. During that time, there was a lot of race intimidation going on. Dallas had the largest Ku Klux Klan lair in the country with 13,000 Klansmen, one of whom became the leader for the entire country.
This was for intimidation. This statue was put in to intimidate the black folks of Dallas.
Exactly. But even in the midst of that intimidation, this amazing community created the Hall of Negro Life. And if you look historically, it was so well regarded. They did such a good job. They had all this traffic, and there was such a pride around seeing the Hall of Negro Life. And that Hall of Negro Life went up in 1936 with everything else, but that was destroyed in 1937. So when they talk about wanting to maintain Dallas history, I'm like, let's tell the whole history. They destroyed that hall the next year.
Give me a sense of what the reaction was like from across Dallas.
Sure. There are a lot of people who are very upset.
What did they say?
They said, you're erasing our history. But one of the reasons we came to the conclusions we did at the end is that we actually had information and history and actual facts that helped us get to where we were. One historian told us, and they brought in the documentation. Apparently, Robert E. Lee specifically said that he did not want any statues made, period.
Why did you get involved with this? I know you talked to the mayor about it. You're a busy person. You didn't have to do this. Talk about yourself. Why are you doing this?
I've been involved in and passionate about civil rights work for basically my whole life. Both of my parents are very involved in the African American community. My father is an African American studies professor. My mother is a religion professor focusing on the African American church and community. I grew up with them really talking to me about the importance of responsibility, that we all have a responsibility to do what we can to move the country toward justice and fairness, equality, and really to deal with what's been the oppression of our people and how do we help move it forward. Because of the work of people before me a generation ago, I don't have to worry about sitting on the back of a bus. So for me, this is the issue for our generation. There's a wonderful quote by Frantz Fanon in a book called The Wretched of the Earth, and he says, every generation must discover its mission, fulfill it or betray it. And I feel like we are living in this amazingly difficult, challenging time in our country right now, and our generation's got to step up and figure out how can we fulfill our mission to make this country a better place for everyone.
Frances Kudrow-Waters, it's been a pleasure having you here. Thanks for visiting with us while we're in Dallas.
Great. Thank you for having me.
Frances Kudrow-Waters is the chairperson of the Dallas Task Force on Confederate Monuments. Welcome back to The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick. We're broadcasting from KERA in Dallas, and a story today that will make Dallas the center of the nation again, just like it was on November 22, 1963.
President Kennedy and Governor John Connally have been cut down by assassins' bullets in downtown Dallas.
And the first thing I remember hearing are what I thought was firecrackers, because Kennedy threw his hands up.
What kind of idiot would be throwing firecrackers with a president driving by?
I saw the president grab at his throat and lurch to his left. So I knew something was wrong. Something had happened.
President Kennedy has been shot as a motorcade left downtown Dallas.
Today, the U.S. government is scheduled to release about 3,100 pages of previously undisclosed documents on the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. And chances are, whatever is in these newly released documents, it's not going to change a lot of minds about who's responsible for JFK's murder. Just ask anyone in Dealey Plaza here in Dallas, and nobody hesitates.
I'm assuming it's a conspiracy, I believe. That's what I think, a government conspiracy, probably cover up.
I have to believe it was Lee Harvey Oswald. I can't see any other logical answer.
I go with the conspiracy as far as being a second shooter at the grassy knoll, just because of the way the head moved back when he got shot.
In an age of conspiracy theories and fake facts, it's the ultimate American conspiracy theory.
Did the CIA assassinate JFK?
Cuba, a mafia.
CIA and a mafia working together.
This was a mafia hit.
LBJ killed JFK.
The single bullet theory.
It's a mystery wrapped in a riddle inside an enigma.
The murder of the President of the United States, the person that all Americans have in common. Theories about the Kennedy assassination are as American as the moon landing itself, if that's even real. Most of the people you see in Dealey Plaza today are tourists and theorists and conspiracy salesmen looking for a mark. And then there's a different type.
My name is Hugh Ainsworth. I've been a reporter for a little over 65 years. And I happen to be here in Dealey Plaza when the president was shot.
Hugh was standing right at the corner of Houston Street and Elm just as the president's motorcade made the left turn under the window of the Texas School Book Depository.
Right across from the depository building, there was a workman with a hard hat on. And he was pointing up to that window. And he said, he's up there. So I saw him. He's been there. So I ran to him, naturally, which was real good because he was the best witness. He described Oswald perfectly, and that's where the all-points bulletin came from.
Hugh went on from that day, chasing claims and witnesses. He's written multiple books on the assassination. Hugh isn't looking for any astounding revelations in the new documents today, but there are still things he wants to know, gaps in the record, things the government kept from the Warren Commission and from others.
Well, I expect what comes out will not change anybody's mind. There'll be, you know, if they don't release it all, they're in for trouble. Because people need to know. Remember at that time, the CIA was involved in trying to kill Castro. Two or three attempts failed. They also had the same thing going with some of the other dictators in some of the Latin American countries. And they were involved far too much in other people's business. So I think that needs to all come out. And if it doesn't, it's going to be trouble for the CIA and to some extent the FBI.
Just a few steps from where Hugh and I are chatting is the Sixth Floor Museum. In the very building where the Texas School Book Depository was housed in 1963, and where Lee Harvey Oswald built a perch and a gun nest out of boxes, opened the window on the sixth floor above Houston and Elm, and fired three shots at President Kennedy as the motorcade passed. Stephen Fagan is the museum's curator.
Right outside, we are looking at the corner of Elm and Houston Street, and it was at that juncture where the motorcade made that hairpin left turn onto Elm Street. It was the very end of the official parade route, and it was where those shots were fired, the shots that killed Kennedy and wounded Governor John Connally. And as a result of that, within 24 hours of the assassination, this site, Dealey Plaza, became the most visited site in Dallas. And today, it's the second most visited historic site in Texas, behind the Alamo in San Antonio. And if you go outside and look around, you'll see young people who have no memories of this whatsoever. They see it as a murder mystery. They see it as something almost intangible, ancient history that they can somehow figure out if they wander the grass of Elm Street. But you also see older individuals lost in thought, thinking more about their own lives and maybe who they were in 1963. So it's a place of memory and catharsis, but it's also a place of mystery and discovery. And it's unique that we have a geographic location like this where we can say world history changed here that means different things to different people.
Fagan is immersed in the details of the assassination. Every name, every witness, every cop, every agent in Dallas that day, and as the investigation went on for years. He avoids talk of conspiracies and absolutely no politics.
Our job, of course, our mission is to contextualize the death of President Kennedy. And so we hope, we anticipate that these files will provide a broader understanding of not just the assassination, but the time period as well. The Warren Commission, we now know, was misled by the FBI and the CIA. That's pretty much established fact. But they weren't able to do the best investigation they could, not necessarily because the FBI and the CIA were complicit in some way, but just the result of a benign cover-up, because the FBI and the CIA knew about Lee Harvey Oswald in the aftermath. Of course, any government agency is going to want to downplay any awareness they had of this particular individual. But in the absence of that, in the shadows of that, you have these theories emerge. Well, maybe the government didn't just keep facts from the Warren Commission. Maybe they actively were involved in this. Maybe rogue elements of the CIA working with the mafia or the Soviet Union. And then all the players, all the usual suspects come to the surface, and it just seems so shadowy and so possible.
Back outside, Hugh Ainsworth says he doesn't come to Dealey Plaza very much anymore. The conspiracy theorists tease him. They call him a government stooge. He likes it inside, in the sixth floor museum, with the facts. And as far as the new government documents on the JFK assassination?
Well, to tell you the truth, I don't need to know too much more. I'm sort of tired of it all, really. It was a terrible thing. It happened 53, 54 years ago, and I don't want to see another 200 different conspiracies, because I've run down at least 20 myself.
Just a couple of feet away is the grassy knoll itself. It looks exactly like it did in 1963. Even the wooden fence where a fourth shot was possibly fired is still there.
So they won't show what we got, so that's unbelievable.
A man at a table sells his videos on alternative theories of the assassination, and close by is Jane Evans from the UK, in Dallas, visiting family. She was a second-year university student in England on November 22nd. She says the shock was real.
For everybody, not just here in America, yes, it washed over us all. Real concern, real fear, real upset as well. He held so much promise for so many people, not just you guys. But the rest of the world was pinning their hopes on him too. And we lost him. Who knows how good it would have been if he'd made it.
We want to give special thanks to the folks at the Sixth Floor Museum here in Dallas. The eyewitness testimony you heard at the top of the piece was courtesy of the museum's oral history collection. You can find a lot more on their website at jfk.org. Our thanks to our friends at KERA for hosting us these past few days. It's been fantastic. I'll be off tomorrow. CNN's Tanzina Vega is filling in for me. In the meantime, thanks so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.